Welcome to Bottom Lines, Top Dollars,
a podcast about all the money things you suspect might be ruining your life.
I'm Laura Boo, recording on the floor of a crowded closet in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, Canada.
And I'm Hadassah Damian, currently in upstate New York at my queer friend's land project. Today's topic, after the pandemic recession, universal basic income doesn't sound so unreasonable. But what is it? Who wants it? And why would it impact you? What I think is we're going to dig into a lot about universal basic income, but to me, just the premise of universal basic income acknowledges that money is one of these, is the basic thing that people need to solve problems. And so, because it's not universal basic housing, it's not universal basic food resources, it's universal basic money income. And so it's this idea that everyone needs money. It acknowledges that we have built a economic society in which, like, that is the key tool that everyone needs, which I don't think we acknowledge often enough, that there's this like function that happens, money that is required, right? We just kind of are born into it and operate within it. So universal basic income is a government sort of program, the conceptual, like, you know, facilitated by like the big organizations that can disperse this kind of thing, government, acknowledging that money is a requirement. And then there's all these different lenses or facets, right, that people and governments will come at it with about, well, why people might get UBI. First, let's back it up and just talk about what it is and why it's on our plate today.
So the idea for universal basic income is that every citizen of a country should receive a minimum payment from the government that is not tied to being poor enough or working to prove that you deserve it. So without a means or a work test, that everyone should receive a basic income. Means test means before you get social programs, you have to prove to the government that you're poor enough to receive them. So this is both checking your income and checking your wealth. So looking at your bank account and your income. And work requirements is the expectation that work capable people will work in return for government benefits. So this is like how for SNAP in the United States, a lot of people are required to work a minimum of 80 hours a month.
And sometimes you're expected to work really busy work jobs because the idea of giving someone money and them not working really offends some people.
Totally. Yeah. Like that concept is untenable unless, I mean, and here's where the edges of capitalism start showing up, right? Where it's like, well, the government can't give people money and have those people not do anything for that money. But if you happen to be born into a wealthy family who gives you money for doing nothing and you get to have money for nothing, well, somehow that's fine.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing about universal basic income being a cash payment. In our two countries, we have a bunch of different social programs. Our two countries take slightly different views on it, but we're kind of on the same side of the spectrum. But we have lots of social programs like in Canada, there's employment insurance, you know, the Canada Pension Plan. We have a welfare system. We also have a healthcare system. We have a lot of, you know, social programs to help our citizens kind of make it through life. And UBI is similar but different in that it's still the government offering support, but it's just straight out giving people cash. And in a way, this appeals to more fundamentally capitalist or right-wing perspectives because it's saying everyone should have a choice about how their money is spent rather than give it to the government and have the government decide that we get universal health care. I want to take my income and decide what I do with it. So it's this idea of this choice. But then the big question becomes, can we trust everybody to make the best choices for themselves? Which is kind of a eugenics-y sort of question, which is saying, is everybody smart enough or capable enough to be trusted with essentially being above the poverty line? You know, and there's this kind of judgment here that poor people are in essence not smart enough to have the means to take care of themselves. We prefer to offer them specific programs where we say, you know, you should get food stamps because, you know, if I give you money straight up, you're going to go and buy something stupid like magic beans. But if I give you food stamps, then you will buy milk for your baby.
If the underlying idea is everyone has to have money, then of course morals and ethics get loaded directly on top of that. You know, are individuals capable of handling money and what happens, right? So it's like, so you have all of these sort of like middle and upper class policy, you know, government type people debating if the majority of the hoi polloi of us can make good decisions with money. And therefore you end up with findings like what we saw in the Stockton, California experiment, which is, hey, wow, light bulb, people can be trusted when you hand them money. So there was like a recent study on the US government handed out $1,200 stimulus checks in April, you know, early pandemic, for families who made less than like $100,000 a year, for individuals who made less than $100,000 a year. Then there was some analysis on what people did with the money. And it was like, I could go grab the numbers, but it was something like, you know, how people spent their stimulus checks. On average, a third of the money got put in savings. And like 40% of the money got put towards basic necessities, like, you know, food and taking care. And, you know, 10% of the money went to consumer goods. So actually, people were highly responsible with money that was handed out, right? A universal, the only means test at play was, are you making less than a certain amount of money, right?
Yeah, it's just that certain amount was really high. So actually, this is one reason why I think UBI is being talked about so much right now, is because what happened with the pandemic, the federal government in both our countries went into a panic and was like, oh my God, we need to prevent a total catastrophe and we are going to give payments directly to citizens. And these payments for the first time were the most universal. They were not entirely universal. There was lots of people who were left out, lots and lots, but it was the closest thing that we've ever gotten to a universal basic income moment. And so in a way, it was the largest experiment that's ever happened.
And Laura, tell us how much money, if you were in Canada.
Oh, that we got? So in Canada.
In
Canada, we had what people either call CERB or CURB. It's different people on different news channels pronounce it differently. But it's the Canadian Emergency Response Benefit. And everyone received $2,000 flat. And that was $2,000.
If you were working and if you weren't working?
No, you had to not be working. The way in which it was more universal is that you didn't have to have lost a job where you were paying into the EI program. So in Canada, if you have a job where you're paid by an employer who takes source deductions, one of the source deductions is to pay into the EI system. And if you lose that job, then you get employment benefits for the duration of the time it takes you to find a new job. But if you are a gig worker, if you are a student, if you are self-employed and your employment or what you're doing and essentially your source of income gets cut off, you don't have access to EI. The way that CURB was different was that they expanded it and they basically said, if you were any of these other things that is not eligible for EI, you can get this $2,000 a month. And it was a really interesting amount too, because disability benefits are not $2,000 a month. And people who were on disability already weren't eligible for CURB. And they were like, hey, so in a panic, you decided that $2,000 was the minimum that every person needed to get by in this country. Yet you have been telling us that we can get by on way less than this for a very long time. So it's been an interesting moment because it, you know, the government had to make decisions so fast that, you know,
they forgot to cover their asses about what they had been saying.
So in the US, you guys did, instead of doing like a flat thing, you did a top up.
We did a top up. Yeah. So every state, like we have such, the way government's actually implemented in the US is fascinating and super heterogeneous because states, we have this idea of states' rights and federalism, and like states do a lot of their own things. And so states implement their own unemployment insurance programs. And so some states, you know, in New York State, you can get up to $500 and something a week. In other states, the max is out at like, you know, $260 a week. So it's really state dependent. And then states manage their own unemployment insurance coffers. And then the way that it worked in the US was if you were eligible for even $1 of unemployment insurance from your state, you were also eligible for a flat $600 a week additional from the federal government. And similarly, the eligibility was expanded to gig workers, self-employed people, part-time workers, et cetera. So if you had been working and lost work became the means test, as opposed to if you worked full-time for somebody else, which is interesting because, again, under this idea of governments forgot to cover their asses, for a long time, the sort of gold standard of work or quote-unquote real work was this working full-time for somebody else thing that enabled you to get, you know, quote, good health insurance and qualify for unemployment in the case of getting laid off your work. But really, the governments of both our countries, it seems, had to acknowledge that the nature of work has changed and that a lot of people work for themselves. A lot of people have like multiple gigs that are being strung together, work part-time, et cetera. And so that's, I think, the other reason actually that UBI is coming up right now. There was the pandemic and we had this sort of instance of evidence that many people could get a bunch of money at the same time. Like in the US, you could get 10 grand, which is a non-trivial amount of money. I know plenty of people who for the first time were able to save money, right? Because of getting this top up. When a couple $100 a week is life-changing for thousands and thousands and thousands of people, that's what we just saw, right? But then take a step back aside from the pandemic, there's also the nature of work is changing and how people make money is changing, right? So the other reason that this conversation about UBI has been happening, these experiments have been happening heightened for the last couple of years is this idea that like, quote unquote, the future of work, what is going to happen when the AIs and the robots do a lot of the work that we used to need to have people to do, and there's not enough, quote, jobs to go around, right? This whole idea that like, well, you have to earn your keep and you have to work. I mean, that's fucking constructed 100%, you know, like David Copperfield, you know, like 1890s, like, you know, don't be an English street urchin, go get your hat on and like newsies or whatever, you know, and then on and on and on, right? Like our entire culture, it's deep. But it is a viable question. Our society is built on this idea that like everyone should try to have a job, but like truly really having to grapple with the fact that there will just not be enough jobs, and many of the jobs that are available are going to be lower paid jobs. There's like already a huge divide building. Like Laura, you and I both talked about how in our, you know, personal kind of shifts to professionalism, like we're both knowledge workers and I'm like, thank fucking God, you know? But like there's going to be knowledge workers and there's going to be like service workers with a huge rift in income between those two work-based classes of people, right? So universal basic income is also coming up as a way to, and this I think starts going into, well, what are the arguments for it? As a way to maintain the status quo as a reformist position, right? If we give the poorest people enough money to not be completely destitute, then we can maintain capitalism enough so like the richest people can keep just scraping resources off the earth to their heart's content, which is not how right-wing people exactly say it, but that's what they're saying. So, but why else? Why else have universal basic income?
Actually, the reasons are really interesting to me as somebody who identifies as an anti-capitalist, because this is one place where there are actually like people arguing for and against this on the left and people arguing for and against this on the right. So like this is one place where when I researched this, I found lots of people making super right-wing arguments for UBI and then super left-wing arguments for UBI. The one that was most fascinating to me was this idea that UBI is going to save capitalism because inequality has become so extreme and because AI and technology is, in essence, hollowing out the middle class and basically removing all these jobs, that there are not enough, quote unquote, good jobs for people, or the vision of the future that a lot of people are building in Silicon Valley is a future in which, you know, machines do most of the work. How do you keep capitalism from collapsing when workers become obsolete in a big way?
It's so interesting because this is also like the vision of a bunch of like 1860s to 1890s socialist literature. Like, side note, like I did like a deep study of like, you know, future socialist fiction back in grad school, because I did whatever I wanted in grad school and it was fascinating.
As we all so this do. Is book, hello.
Yeah. Yes, yes. So this is book 1880 to 2000 by this guy, Edward Bellamy. And somebody falls asleep in 1880 and wakes up in the year 2000. And essentially, like, bullshit jobs are over. he like came up with the idea of a credit card. Everyone has a little like card that they carry around that is their like kind of resource like sheet. And like, you know, he wakes up and there's like no more horrific, overcrowded tenements and like disgusting factories because the robots do it all. Right. So like, and his vision was socialist, hardcore socialist. There was like basically almost socialism in the US in the 1880s and 90s until the Rockefellers won, essentially.
I think a lot about science fiction when I think about UBI, because I realize that in most science fiction, except for really dystopian science fiction, UBI is kind of like oddly assumed, you know, like in Star Trek and other kind of futuristic science fiction worlds where money just doesn't seem to exist. The assumption is that everyone's basic needs are taken care of, right? Money doesn't exist because resources are managed in such a way where everyone is taken care of. And then in that world, what are people doing? People are engaging in the kind of work that is motivated by dreams and desires and discovery. You know, there's kind of like this idea
of going where no man has gone before.
Yes, when you're released from the fear of not making it, when you're released from the fear of homelessness and starvation, what can you achieve then? And this is the thing that boggles my mind, is when people are like, if someone is released from the obligation to work, society will disintegrate. And I'm like, no, man, if you release them from those chains, society will prosper.
So, and that's where this idea is so fascinating, because it's like super right wing. Capitalism is breaking, so let's keep it. And then there's this other side, which is capitalism is breaking, so let's take away all the jobs that nobody has to do and have robots instead, because socialism.
Well, the promise of the Industrial Revolution, and, you know, if you think of the technological revolution as kind of the inheritor of that, the idea that you bring in machines and machines do labor of people, the idea was that the machines would replace us and therefore free us up. It was supposed, you know, it was pitched as like the way in which the working class could actually become free of backbreaking labor. It was about bringing in a shorter work week. You know, the advent of the 40-hour work week was a revolutionary concept. And we haven't had a decrease in the work week in 100 years, more than 100 years. But the idea was that as technology can take on more labor, that it's supposed to create freedom for humans to have more personal time and more choice. David Graeber was like, why, as we've created increasing productivity and efficiency through technology, is the work week not diminishing? Instead, what we're doing is creating a massive amount of what he calls bullshit jobs. A lot of people do jobs with little meaning or impact. And it's mostly in order to keep people working. And keeping people busy and working is a way to keep society from changing.
Right. And it's only a thing to be petrified of if actually what having a job means is that you can put food in your mouth and survive. That's the only reason to be afraid. Yeah.
Yeah. If you told somebody you can still eat, you can still live, and you don't have to go and work this machine that will literally eat your children in a factory, like, and take your fingers off, like, people would be like, oh yeah, cool, fine. I'll just go do something else. I'll make art. You know, like, you know, the promise of the Industrial Revolution that was made to the working class was that machines will free you. You know, before mm-hmm. the machine era, people were working 60, 70, 80 hours a week. They were working 10 and 12 hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week. The 40-hour work week was in part substantiated by the fact that machines were making society more productive and that you could produce more in less time. Therefore, working class people were allowed to have a weekend.
Right. But if you go before that, right, like before machine production, we still had this idea of creating more value than you need in order to exchange, right? Because you had to exchange to get other things you couldn't create. But if you go back before that economically, there's various research that indicates that like agricultural pre-exchange societies, people worked more like 4 to 6 hours a day. Like when you were trying to farm for yourself, or you were just farming for yourself and like harvesting the commons, you know, like maintaining the commons, like there was actually a lot less work that happened. And so we, you know, arguments for UBI are like kind of couched in this, in norms around work. But norms around work are like constructed based on how much, what work allows us to do. And so if work is something I have to do to exchange to survive, I'm incentivized to do a lot more work. Pro arguments for UBI about work are just tied into this idea of why people have to work, you know? And so it's worth digging into, because one of the con arguments is like, if we give people UBI, no one will want to work. Quote, nobody will do anything, which is moralistic yes. at best, right?
That argument actually is really interesting, the pro and con of it. So to say, look, if everyone has a minimum amount of income, and simultaneously machines are taking our jobs, then, you know, there can be this moment where every individual can either choose to pursue their own interests, be entrepreneurs or artists or other, you know, they can decide to live on less, i.e. what they receive as their minimum income, and mm-hmm. just live, you know, more low to the ground, which some people would argue is more sustainable and better for the environment, consuming less. But the minimum, like, we're not talking about sending people $5,000 a month, $10,000 a month, $100,000 a year. The basic and minimum basic income is real, real basic. It's usually set at somewhere around the poverty line or just above it.
So, like, for example, and this, like, listeners can get a sense of where the poverty line is, because most people don't know where it is. In the United States, the poverty line is set by the Census Bureau, and it is set as 3 times the minimum food diet in 1963, which means you guys haven't redefined it since 1963.
Yeah, and we're garbage.
That means that
it's $12,000? Like, it's something.
I'm shocked. You're so good. In 2020, for a single person, the poverty line in the United States is $12,760, and for a family of four, it's set at $26,200. That's the poverty line.
You could maybe get by on that if you were very careful, but you're not buying a home or having cars or going on vacations. And really,
and in the US, where's your health insurance? Yeah, all of it.
So to say that it will, to give people the absolute basic will disincentivize them from working, is to say that people won't want to do a little bit of extra work in order to have the extra things they want in life, like, you know, buying clothes that they like, or going on vacation, or going to concerts, or going out to restaurants. There's an argument that it will remove people from the necessity to work too much, to work 40, 50, 60 mm-hmm. hours, to work double jobs just to make it. And by people only taking jobs that are enough to give them that top up to live at the level that they want to live, that will actually return equilibrium to the labor market in a way, which is an interesting argument for both sides, where it says, you know, it'll disincentivize people to work. No, it'll reincentivize people to work for jobs that they have passion for, and to work in a way that actually makes it so that the equilibrium of negotiating power between labor and capital, or your bosses, is reestablished.
Oh, Laura, we can't have that. How's capitalism going to go on? No, what it does is it disincentivizes exploiting your workforce, right? Or it because your workforce is in less of a position to be exploited by your shitty yes. job. you know? And so, yeah, I can imagine some employers are like not happy about that. I'm thinking of the Walmarts of the world, right? Like they're horrific employers, for example, you know, or like the like Amazon sort of warehouses of the world, horrific employers who get along and get their employees because people are like, well, I have to make money somehow.
How will universal basic income, you know, affect, if at all, people's motivation or interest in working? And what I always think is inside that question is this assumption that the only motivator for work is getting money. And up to a certain point, money is a good motivator, right? It tends to be, at least in the US, somewhere between making between, you know, $70,000 to $90,000. You are, you know, if we think of the poverty line in the US, $12,000, somewhere between $12,000 and $75,000 to $90,000, you are still just hitting needs. Like you're covering the things that you need, right? And, you know, getting a couple extras, we're not talking about a Tesla, we're talking about like time off work. But after you get to a certain point, money is not the key motivator. But we as a society, for sure in the US, kind of assume that like, well, nobody would work if people didn't need money, which to me underlies this experience that a lot of people are having, which is that a lot of people wouldn't work the jobs they have if they didn't need money. But I don't know that it's necessarily true. And we don't have validation that it's true that nobody would get up in the morning and do something with their day if they didn't need money. But people actually might not do things that they don't want to do. And so there's a way in which universal basic income could potentially bring in a like experience of consent to people's lives that is greatly missing right now. And of course, capitalism functions because of this lack of consent. People are like situationally coerced into doing all kinds of things, often work-related things that they wouldn't do otherwise, right? And UBI makes us acknowledge that fact is true. It's not that, quote, people wouldn't work. It's that actually people might prefer to do things that they would enjoy doing with their time or that are their natural, you know, gifts or skill sets, as opposed to just like however they got the job that they have.
What it does is it starts to like release the valve of total non-consent exploitation in capitalism. And so that's where we go back to this like, well, is it a reformist position because it releases the valve and it allows capitalism to maintain? Or is it like an abolitionist position where it allows us to move towards ending capitalism because people won't have to grind themselves in horrific jobs they don't want, right? And again, UBI, so interesting because it's got both. And then another reason people are against it is this idea that it's like, well, that's not fair, that like folks shouldn't have to work for money. And again, it's this moral position that like at its heart is each of us should be okay with like being exploited, not really getting to choose if we work, which is pretty brutal, honestly, at its heart. It's like just it's internalized how it works to be in a capitalist society. Right.
Absolutely. And I'm this idea that it's not fair, like if you don't work and you receive money, that's not fair to somebody who does work and receives money. That has the basic assumption that everyone works shit jobs that they don't want. It's like, why should I be forced to do something I don't want and you not have to do that? And if you're in a situation where you have your basics covered, then the desperation factor is taken out and we can seek jobs that we actually like. But the other part of the argument here about it's not fair is saying, well, some people think of UBI as what they call like a society dividend. And the idea here is that every citizen of a country is owed money as inheritors of the society and infrastructure that their ancestors built in building that country. And all companies in both Canada and the US depend on infrastructure for their success. Now, this means that every company in the world needs there to be certain things in place for them to function. Otherwise, they would have to build them themselves and it would be far too expensive and they'd never be able to profit. So think of it like this. Amazon can't make profits unless there are roads for the delivery trucks to drive on. Every company needs, you know, to access the electricity grids and the sewer systems and If not, then they have to build them. Every single company.
Right, banking insurance to like ensure that like the money system stays in
the
place.
The court system. In Canada and US, the fundamental thing that makes capitalism work is contract law and a court system that upholds contract law. And the court systems are funded by the government. Beyond that, there's also the fact that most of the most successful companies in modern capitalism are companies that have built their entire profits on foundational technologies that were publicly funded, like the internet.
Internet, like we're using right now.
In this sense, UBI is saying, look, the government built all these things and the government is funded by the people. Therefore, the people invested in all these things and you use those things to make profits. Therefore, in a way, the government and the people are like your shareholders. They invested in your company. And that means that society should start paying everybody out dividends. This is a fascinating, I mean, this is like an ultra capitalist way to argue.
It's also so ultra left. I mean, what I love about it is it makes the implicit explicit in that, like, where is the source of wealth generated, right? I mean, it's like this idea that, oh, if we just harvest stuff from the earth and sell it, we make money. I'm like, well, what was the source? The source is something you're pulling from the earth, right? So like in the example of like harvesting, you know, digging up coal or whatever, or like growing food and then selling it, you know, it's like there is a layer that gets made implicit and ignored, which is like the rain and the soil and the earth stuff, right? Which is like, which people have pretended is free because somewhere along the way, somebody didn't have to pay for it. So it's not as valued. But it's really interesting because, yeah, like it's making the baseline resources that go into making the next thing possible explicit and saying that they have value, which they do, right? If nobody maintains the roads, you're not going to get your Amazon in one day. Also, why, for the most part, you probably don't need things in one day. But anyway.
I mean, and it's fascinating to me because this argument is basically saying all these kind of non-direct or sort of really long-term investments that are more kind of distant than a direct ownership of a company, that those actually should be paying out to citizens. And I mean, in here, I feel like the right-wing things that I read and listened to on YouTube, I'm not sure if they realize that that is like one step away from reparations, one step away from saying, what about all the investment that was made by slaves or indigenous people? Like it doesn't get there, but it's kind of like a halfway argument to that. Mm. And when you say it's universal, it's saying everybody gets it. Absolutely everybody. No matter whether you are a recent citizen or a citizen who is indigenous, who's been here before anybody else, or somebody who is the descendant of someone who was brought here against their will, everybody gets these payments, rich and poor, which basically is saying that all people in that society are equal and deserving of the benefits of citizenship, and in essence makes all those people equal owners of society. So it's this very kind of like egalitarian sort of concept. And it's so funny to me that, you know, there's all these arguments that people are really making where they're trying to get deeper and deeper into justifying it through capitalism. And then there's all these other people on the side who are like, let's be real, alleviation of poverty. Why are we living in a society where there is massive, massive inequality? And there are some people who are living in horrific conditions, who are working so many jobs to not even get by. And a lot of these people who are trying to access the social infrastructure to survive, either through welfare or SNAP or whatever programs, a lot of accessing those programs involves an enormous amount of very degrading labor,
right,
and time. And on the side of the government is a huge amount of administration. And, you know, there's one Canadian senator, Hugh Segal, who basically called UBI the most efficient, humane, and non-stigmatizing way to provide social services. Because, you know, in welfare, you have to demonstrate that you are destitute. And EI, you have to constantly fill out reports. in order to prove that you still need it is highly stigmatizing. And universal basic income takes that all away.
Right. So it takes out like a layer of like this middle management bureaucracy, which could make governments run more cheaply. Right. And so like this is getting into these questions of like, but how do we pay for it? You know, like, is it corporations who have made so much money? Is it the foundations, you know, and these sort of like old, like, you know, like patriarchal philanthropists, you know, like the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and the Mellons, you know, who made a bunch of money based on like land value and extraction value in like the 19th century, you know, who now give away tiny little fractions of their money every year, you know, which
thanks,
could fund.
Guys.
Hey, thanks so much. You're giving away the bare minimum so that you can continue to keep and make as much money as possible. Cool. We're going to get into that in like another segment. Yeah. Thanks so much.
Yeah, that's definitely our next episode where we talk about
the question like that we hear is how do we pay for it? And I'm just like, this brings us back to the pandemic, because this idea that like governments in the US and Canada could be like, oh, so we need a couple trillion dollars. Beep, boop. Hey, we made it. Like reminds us that like since like the end of the gold standard and really like with the creation of like modern sort of like digital money systems, the idea of fractional reserves, it's like you only money gets invented. If you need more money, someone will invent the money. They'll just add a credit line or a debit line. Like Laura, you know more about this than I do, but then boop, money has been created. When you go to get a mortgage and you borrow $200,000, it's not like somebody opens up a safe and takes out that money. It's a debit line on somebody's like accounting somewhere. Boop, $200,000 has been created that now you are going to earn the money to pay back. You know, money gets invented. So who's going to pay for it? Just a spreadsheet is going to invent it.
The spreadsheets will pay for it. Oh my God. Like there's no way to pay for it is the fundamental argument where they're like, it's too expensive. And then you have all these people on the internet doing these calculations where they're like, and it's going to cost this many billions and this many trillions. And where does that come from? And all that's doing is frightening a populace by putting big numbers in front of their face and telling them that they owe that to the government. And then people are like, oh, it's absolutely unreasonable. But a lot of people have suggested a lot of ways to pay for it. You know, one being that, and I don't think that there's one single way, but, you know, if UBI becomes a thing, then it in some way can replace at least some social programs. You know, the right wing is like all social programs, it replaces all. And on the left, there's varying degrees of saying, yes, it can replace some. No, it can't replace anything. You know, some people are arguing that UBI should be on top of welfare, on top of EI, on top of Social Security and retirement plans. Some people suggest that it can replace some of them, like EI and welfare. But either way, there's a reduction in administrative costs, which are quite substantial. If it replaces some of those programs, then it's a shifting of funding that already exists from one thing to another. Okay, that takes care of some of it. Where does the rest come from? And some people suggest, you know, that UBI should be a business expense, that any company that accesses public infrastructure, which is every company, you know, every company accesses the court system, the roads, employs people educated by public systems of education, that it essentially be charged to companies as like an employer contribution to the social system. So like a user fee for infrastructure. And then other people are straight up like wealth tax.
You know? Scrape it off the top.
Yeah, but like so much is there. Just take like a little bit off the top and spread it around to everybody.
We have to wrap it up in a minute, but I feel like my final observation on this part of the topic is that like often we think of taxes as this lump thing. Taxes, they go to stuff. And what's happening here is the definition of what stuff those taxes are going to go to ahead of time, and then defining, you know, what the tax rate might be on that, which if we were to even stop and think of our taxes as like, well, I pay my military tax and my HUD tax and my Medicaid tax and my Medicare tax and my administrative fees tax and my city tax and my library's tax and my teacher's tax, like we would all feel a whole bunch of kind of ways about where our money goes. And so in some ways, you could also just reallocate the taxes that are already being taken, you know, to something like this or up the tax rate.
Oh, yeah, because there's so many arguments that UBI will actually save costs in so many other places. You know, some of these experiments that have already happened where, you know, sociologists and economists have tried tiny experiments in UBI. Like in the 70s, there was an experiment in a little farming town called Dauphin, Manitoba, where they tried a UBI-like program. It was a top-up program, so not pure UBI, but more people graduated from high school. There was a huge decrease in medical costs. And those kinds of things, like a decrease in costs related to poverty, having a massive population of poor people is actually very, very expensive for any government.
If you find a way to eliminate poverty, what other externalities does it eliminate from society? Being a part of a society where there are people who are suffering costs everybody money. In Canada, it costs us an enormous amount of money through the healthcare system because we have a public healthcare system. The amount of hospitalizations that come out of living a life of desperation is massive.
As far as like, how will we pay for it? We're already paying for it through the nose in a super disorganized way. So
to me, minimum basic income is just going to relieve people from misery, because this is really the argument for UBI, is the elimination of poverty.
Yes, that's it. All right. Next episode, we're going to be talking about the other small percent of the small percent that is the 0.01%. We're going to be talking about billionaires.
God, yes.
Oh
yes.
My God. All right. Laura, it's always a pleasure to convo with you.
Bye, Damien.
Bye. Thank you everyone for listening. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Bottom Lines, Top Dollars.
We've been your hosts, the ladies who crunch. That's me, Laura Boo.
And me, Hadassah Damien from Ride Free Fearless Money. You can find this show and show notes on the web at ladieswhocrunch.club.
And you can find us all over social media. Just search for Bottom Lines, Top Dollars, or Ladies Who Crunch.
I want to give a special thanks to our researchers, Ariel Federow and Handy Levine, and to all of our friends who suggest topics to us and to the wild shit show that is late stage capitalism itself. Because remember, if anything you learned or heard in this podcast made you angry, good.
If you're mad about it, we still have hope.